of the Aenir. The clan lords were clearly uncomfortable. Magris of the Pallades was furious. The games were a clan affair. Yet last night, Campbell had sprung upon them his invitation for the Aenir to enter a team. The argument had raged for over an hour.
"Are you mad?" Magrig had stormed. "Has the Adelfarland mind finally betrayed you?"
"I am the game's lord this year. They are on Farland land. It is my decision," Campbell answered, fighting to control his anger.
"Be that as it may, Campbell,"
put in the white-haired Larrick, hunt lord of the Hasten.
"But should any one man be allowed to set a precedent, others will be forced to follow."
He was known to be a man rarely aroused to anger, yet his thin face was flushed now, his fists clenched.
"It is my decision," Campbell repeated stonily.
Larrick bit back his anger.
"The Aenir have no friends, only vassals. They have tried to scout all our lands and have been turned back. You realize that if they win outright, we are obliged to allow them access. The game's champions can travel and hunt where they will."
"They will not win," said Campbell. "They are not clansmen."
"Calling you a fool serves nothing," said Larrick, "for you have proven that beyond my speculation. What breaks my heart is that one man's foolishness could bring about the ruin of the clans."
There was a gasp from the assembled hunt lords, and Campbell sat very still, his face ashen. Magrig rose.
"I am tempted to take the Pallades home, away from this stupidity. Yet I cannot," he said, "for without them, the Aenir would have a greater chance of victory. I suspect it is the same for every lord here. But to tell you this, Campbell, until now I've had scant respect for you. From today even that is a thing of the past. It matters not a whit to me if the Farlane are run by a fool. That hurts only the Farlane. But when you put the Pallades at risk, I cannot forgive you."
Colour drained from Campbell's face.
"How dare you? You think I care what some pot-bellied outclan thinks of me? Take your ragbag carls home, with or without the Aenir. Your Pallades would win nothing, only humiliation." "Hark! The Aenir lapdog can still bark," snapped Magrig.
"Enough of this," stormed Larrick, as Magrig and Campbell moved towards one another.
"Listen to me. I have no love for the Farland nor for the Pallades, but we are clansmen, and no man will violate the spirit of the games. There will be no violence among the hunt lords. The thing has been done, and long will it be argued over, but it is done. Now, let us consider the order of events, or we'll be here all night."
Later, as Magrick and Larrick walked back to their tents in the moonlight, the taller Hasten lord was deep in thought. Magrig also kept silent. Larrick, the oldest hunt lord in Druin, approaching 60 years of age, was also by far the wisest. Magrig liked him, though he'd swallow live coals rather than tell him so. They reached Larrick's tent first, and the older man turned to Magrig, resting a hand on his shoulder.
"Campbell is a fool. He cannot see that which should be clear to every clansman. The Aenir are tomorrow's enemy. My land borders yours, Magrig, and we have had many disputes ere now. But if the Aenir cross Pallades land, I shall bring my clansmen to your aid."
Magrig smiled. It was a nice ploy, but the fact remained that for the Aenir to cross Pallades borders, they must march through either Farland land or Hasten, and the Hasten were less powerful than the Farland. Larrick was asking for an ally.
"Between us, we have perhaps 2,000 fighting men," said Magrig. "Do you think they could stop an Aenir army?"
"Perhaps."
"Agreed, then. We will be allies. I would expect, of course, to be warlord."
"Of course," said Larrick.
"Good night."
The following morning, Magrig stood alongside Asbedag, biting back his anger. The two men could have been brothers. Both had striking red beards, flecked with silver. Both were powerfully built. Deva watched them with anxiety. They were so similar, until you looked into their eyes. There was no evil in Magrick. Deva looked away. Campbell's opening speech of welcome was short, and he quickly outlined the order of the games. The first event would be the mountain run, 5 miles on a twisting circuit through woods and valleys. 300 men were entered, and the Hunt Lords had decided on 6 qualifying races. The first 5 in each race would contest 2 semi-finals, and 15 of the fastest, strongest clansmen would run the final on the last day. Other qualifying events were outlined, and then it was left to Deva, in a flowing dress of white linen, garlanded with flowers, to signal the start of the first race. The named athletes, Galen and Agwain among them, jostled for position as Deva's arm swept up, hovered momentarily, then flashed down, and the race began. Casualin watched the start, saw Galen running smoothly in the centre of the pack, and knowing the youth would qualify easily, strolled to the market stalls on the edge of the field. The stalls were doing brisk business in brooches, daggers, trinkets and tools, cloths, furs, blankets and shoes, meats, cheeses, fruit and vegetables. Casualin eased through the massed crowds, seeking a necklace for Meg. Finding nothing to his taste, he bought a jug of mead and an oatmeal loaf. There were still 1 or 2 empty tables at the edge of the field, and he chose a place away from the crowd, where he would be alone with his thoughts. Since his talk with Meg, he had been less obsessed with the Aenir threat, but now, as was his way, he thought the problem through, examining every angle. Morgasa and Drada were sitting less than 30 paces away, but hidden by the crowd, Casualin did not see them. Morgasa was bored, and her eyes flickered over the mass of people seeking something of even passing interest. She saw the tall man walking to the empty table, and her gaze lingered, her eyes widening in alarm. He wore a leaf-green cloak and a tunic of polished brown leather, while across his chest hung a baldric bearing 2 slim daggers. By his side was a long hunting knife. His trews were green, laced with leather thongs. Morgasa stared intently at the face. The short, trident beard confused her, but the eyes were the same deep green she remembered so well, and with such hatred. She stood and walked over to where he sat. "Good morning," she said, her throat tight, her anger barely controlled. Casualin looked up. Before him was a woman dressed in black, a sleek fitting gown that hid nothing of her slender figure. Her dark hair was braided and curled like a crown on her head and pinned with gold. He rose. "Good morning, lady." He gestured for her to be seated and asked if he could bring her refreshments. Then he saw Drada approaching, carrying 2 goblets of wine.
"How are you, Casualin?" asked Drada.
"Well? Will you introduce me to the lady?"
"You do not know me, then?"
asked Morgasa, surprised.
"I have been known to be forgetful, lady, but not insane. Such beauty as yours is unforgettable."
She seemed confused, uncertain.
"You are very like someone I once knew. Uncannily like."
"I hope he was a friend," said Casualin.
"He was not."
"Then allow me to make up for it," he said, smiling. "Will you join me?"
"No, I must go, but please, since you two know each other, why don't you finish your drinks together?"
The men watched her walk away.
"A strange woman," said Drada.
"Who is she?"
"Morgasa, my father's consort. Beautiful but humorless."
"She thought she knew me?"
"Yes." "Are you taking part in the games?"
"I am."
"In what event?" asked Drada.
"Short sword."
"I thought you were a runner."
"I was."
"You're well informed."
"And you?" No, I'm afraid I excel at very little.
You seem to excel in the field of selection, said Caswellan. Rarely have I seen men train as hard.
Drada smiled. The India like to win.
I wonder why.
What does that mean? No man likes to lose.
True, but no clansman trains for the games. They are an extension of his life and his natural skills. If he loses, he shrugs. It is not the end of the world for him.
Perhaps that is why you are clansmen, living a quiet life in these beautiful mountains, while the Enyer conquer the continent.
Yes, that is what I was thinking, said Caswellan.
Was it your idea to have us escorted here?
I was afraid you might get lost.
That was kind of you.
I am a kind man, said Caswellan. I shall also see that you're escorted back.
Campbell assured us that would not be necessary, or is he not the Hunt Lord?
Indeed he is, but we are a free people, and the Hunt Lord is not omnipotent.
You take a great deal on yourself, Caswellan. Why can we not be friends? As you have seen, the Anir have respected your borders. We trade. We are neighbours.
It is not necessary for you and me to play these games, Drada. I know what is in your heart. Like all killers, you fear that a greater killer will stalk you as you stalk others. You cannot exist with a free people on your borders. You must always be at war with someone. And one day, if you ever achieve your ambition and the Anir rule from sea to sea in every direction, even then, it will not end. You will turn on yourselves like rabid wolves. Today you strike fear into men's hearts, but tomorrow, then you will be thought of as a boil on the neck of history.
The words were spoken without heat. Drada sipped his wine, then he looked up to meet Caswellan's gaze.
I can see why you think as you do, but you are wrong. All new civilizations begin with bloodshed and horror, but as the years pass, they settle down to prosper, to wax and to grow fat. Then, as they reach their splendid peak, a new enemy slips over the horizon and the bloodshed begins anew.
The Farlan will be your undoing, said Caswellan. You are like the man poised to stamp on the worm beneath his feet, too far above to see it is a viper.
Even so, when the man stamps, the viper dies, said Drada.
And the man with it?
Drada shrugged.
All men die at some time.
Indeed they do, my bonnie. But some die harder than others.
For 10 days the games progressed, and the fear of the Hunt Lords grew. The Anir competed ferociously, bringing new edge to the competitions. Gone was any semblance of friendly rivalry. The foreigners battled as if their lives depended on the result. By the evening before the last day, an overall Anir victory had moved from possibility to probability. Only the athletes of the Farlan could overhaul them. The Anir had won all but two of the short sprint finals, had defeated Gwalchmai in the archery tourney, but lost to Lane in the spear. Caswellan had beaten the Anir challenger in the short sword, but lost the final to Intosh, the Palades swordsman. Galen and Agwain had fought their way to the final 5-mile race planned for the morrow, though Agwain had only reached it when a Hasten runner twisted his ankle hurdling a fallen tree. His disappointment in qualifying in such a manner was deepened by the fact that the Anir athlete, the white-haired Borak, had beaten Galen into second place in their semi-final. Lennox, in an awesome display of sheer power, had strolled comfortably to the final of the strength event, but here he was to face the fearsome might of the giant Orsa, himself unbeaten. The Anir had won grudging respect from the clansmen, but all the same, the games had been spoiled. Campbell remained withdrawn throughout the tournament, knowing in his heart the scale of his error. The unthinkable was on the verge of reality. The Anir were 2 events from victory. He had summoned Galen and Agwain to him, and the trio sat before the broad empty hearth of Campbell's home.
Are you confident of beating this Borak, Gielan?
Campbell asked, knowing now that his own son could not compete at their level. Gielan rubbed his eye, choosing his answer carefully.
I saw no point in making a push yesterday. It would only show him the limit of my speed. But on the other hand, he concealed from me his own reserves. No, I am not confident, but I think I can beat him.
What do you think, Arguin?
I can only agree with Gielan, father. They are superbly matched. I would not be surprised either way.
You've both performed well and been a credit to the Farlan. Though you are adopted, Gielan, you have the heart of a clansman. I wish you well.
Thank you, Hunt Lord.
Go home and rest. Do not eat too heavy a breakfast.
Gielan left the house and wandered to the pine fence before the yard. Turning, he looked up at Diva's window, hoping to see a light. There was none. Disappointed, he opened the gate and began the short walk through the woods to Caswellan's house in the valley. The night was bright, the moon full, and a light breeze whispered in the branches overhead. He thought about the race and its implications. It was true that he was not confident of victory, but he would be surprised if the Aenir beat him. He thought he had detected an edge of fatigue in the blonde runner as he came off the mountain on the last circuit of the field. Gielan hadn't pressed then, but had watched his opponent carefully. The man's head had been bobbing during the last 200 paces, and his arms pumped erratically. Gielan had finished all of 30 paces adrift, and it would be closer tomorrow. Caswellan had pointed out one encouraging thought. No one had yet tested Borak. Did he have the heart to match his speed? A dark shadow leapt at Gielan from the left, another from the right. He ducked and twisted, using his forearm to block a blow from a wooden club. He hammered his fist into the belly of the nearest man, following it with a swift hook to the jaw. The attacker dropped, as if poleaxed. As he hurled himself to the right, Galen's shoulder cannoned into the midriff of the second man. The grunting whoosh of his opponent's breath showed he was badly winded. Scrambling to his feet, Gielan kicked the fallen man in the face. More men ran from the trees. In the darkness, Gielan could not recognize faces, but they were dressed like clansmen. He caught an attacker with a right cross to the chin, but then a wooden club thudded against his temple. Gielan reeled to the left, vainly holding up his arm to protect his head. The club hammered into his thigh, and agony lanced him. Another blow to the calf, and he collapsed to the ground, struggling to rise as a booted foot crashed into his face. Twice more he felt blows to his right leg, and he passed out. It was dawn before he was found. Caswellan came across the unconscious body as he made his way to Campbell's home. The clansman had been worried about Gielan staying out all night before the race, but had assumed he was sleeping at the house of the Hunt Lord. Carefully he turned Gielan to his back, checking his heartbeat and breathing. He probed the dried blood on the youth's temple. The skull was not cracked. With a grunt of effort, he lifted Gielan to his shoulder and stumbled on towards the house. Deva was the first to be awakened by Caswellan kicking at the door. She ran downstairs, pulled back the bolts and let him in. Walking past her, Caswellan eased Gielan down into a leather chair. Deva brought some water from the kitchen and a towel to bathe Galen's head. Campbell, bare-chested and barely awake, joined them.
"What has happened?" he asked, bending over the unconscious youth. "From the tracks, I'd say 5 men set on him after he left here last night," Caswellan told him. "Why?"
Caswellan glanced at him, green eyes blazing.
"Why do you think? I was a fool not to consider it myself. You think the Aenir? You want further proof?"
Caswellan carefully unlaced the thongs of Galen's leggings, pulling them clear. His right leg was mottled blue, the knee swollen and pulpy. He groaned as Caswellan checked the bones for breaks.
"Skillfully done, wouldn't you see?" "I shall cancel the race," said Campbell.
"And what reason will you give?" snapped Caswellan. "And what purpose would it serve?"
We need to win both of today's events. Cancelling one will only give the trophy to the Aenir.
Egwene stood at the foot of the stairs, watching the exchange. He said nothing, moving past his father and making his way to the yard. From here he gazed out over the game's field and the mountains beyond. Deva joined him, a shawl across her shoulders, her white nightdress billowing in the morning breeze. Curling her arm about his waist, she rested her head on his shoulder.
"What are you thinking?" she asked.
"I was thinking of father."
"In what way?"
"Oh, I don't know. Many ways. He's wrong. I know that now. The games were ruined from the moment he allowed Draddor to honey-talk him into allowing an Aenir team. But they flattered him so."
"You're disappointed?"
"Yes, I suppose I am. Do not misunderstand me, Deva. I love father dearly, and I would give anything for him to be respected as he desires to be. But like all men, he has limits. He makes mistakes."
"Galen's waking up."
"Yes, but he won't run today."
"No, but you will, brother."
"Yes,"
he answered, sighing.
"Yes, I will."
The field was packed, the stalls deserted, as 3,000 clansmen thronged the start of the mountain race. The 15 runners, dressed only in kilted loincloths and moccasins, were separated from the crowd by a lane of corded ropes, staking the first 200 paces before the long climb into the timberline. Egwene eased his way through the athletes to stand beside the tall Borak. The man looked to neither right nor left, his eyes fixed ahead, ears tuned for the command to run. As game's lord, it was Campbell's duty to start the race. Beside him stood Asbadag and Morgassa, Magrick, Larrick, and the other hunt lords of minor clans. Campbell lifted his arm.
"Ready yourselves," he shouted.
The crowd fell silent, the runners tensing for the race.
"Race!"
yelled Campbell, and the athletes tore away, jostling for position in the narrow roped lane. Egwene settled in behind Borak and was pulled to the front of the pack as the lean Aenir surged ahead. Galen, walking with the aid of a staff, watched, feeling sick with disappointment. Beside him, Lennox and Lane were cheering their cousin. The runners neared the base of the mountain, Egwene and the Aenir some 20 paces ahead of the pack. Borak shortened his step, leaning forward into the hill, his long legs pounding rhythmically against the packed clay. A thin film of sweat shone on his body, and his white gold hair glistened in the sunlight. Egwene, his gaze pinned on his opponent's back, was breathing easily, knowing the testing time would come before the third mile. It was at this point that he had been broken in the semi-final, the Aenir increasing his pace and burning off his opponents. He had learned in that moment the strength-sapping power of despair. The crowd below watched them climb, and Asbadag leaned over to Campbell.
"Your son runs well," he said.
"Thank you.
But where is the boy with the white flash in his hair?"
Campbell met his gaze.
"He was injured last night in a brawl."
"I'm sorry to hear that," said Asbadag smoothly. "Some trouble between the clans, perhaps?"
"Yes, perhaps," answered Campbell.
The runners reached the 2-mile mark and swung along the top of the slope, past a towering cliff of chalk and into the trees on the long curve towards home. Egwene could no longer hear the following runners, only his heart hammering in his chest and the rasping of his breath. But still he kept within 3 paces of the man before him. Just before the 3-mile mark, Borak increased the length of his stride, forging a 10-pace lead before Egwene responded. Caswellan had pulled the young Farlan aside earlier that day, after Galen's wounds had been tended.
"I know we don't see eye to eye on many things, cousin," Caswellan had told him, "but force yourself
to believe what I am going to tell you. You know that I won the mountain race 3 years ago. The way I did it was to destroy the field just after halfway, the same method the Anir used in the semi-final, so I know how his mind works. He has no finish sprint. His one gamble is to kill off his opponents. When he breaks away, it will hurt him. His legs, just like yours, will burn and his lungs will be on fire. Keep that in mind. Each pain you feel, he feels. Stay with him. Egwene didn't know how the Anir felt at this moment, but as he fought to hold back the distance between them, the pain in his legs increased and his breathing grew hot and ragged. But step by step, he gained, until at last he was nestled in behind the warrior. Twice more Borak fought to dislodge the dogged clansman. Twice more, Egwene closed the gap. Up ahead, hidden behind a screen of bushes, knelt an Anir warrior. In his hand was a leather sling, in the pouch of which hung a round black stone. He glimpsed the runners and readied himself. He could see the shorter clansman was close to Borak, and he cursed. Difficult enough to fell a running man without having the risk of striking his comrade. Still, Borak knew he was here. He would pull ahead. The runners were nearer now, and the Anir lifted his sling. "Are you lost, my bonnie?" The warrior swung round, dropping the sling hurriedly. "No, I was watching the race." "You picked a good position," said Caswellan, smiling. "Yes. Shall we walk back together and observe the finish?" "I'll walk alone," snapped the Anir, glancing away down the trail in time to see the runners leave the woods on the last stretch of slope before the final. "As you please," said Caswellan. Borak was worried now. He could hear the cursed clansman behind him, and within moments he would be clear of the trees. What in Vatn's name was Snorri waiting for? Just before they came in sight of the crowds below, Borak chopped his pace. As Egwene drew abreast of him, Borak's elbow flashed back, the point smashing Egwene's lips and snapping his head back. At that moment, Borak sprinted away out of the trees onto the gentle slope and down to the valley. Egwene stumbled, recovered his balance, and set off in pursuit. Anger flooded him, swamping the pain of his tired legs. In the field below, 3,000 voices rose in a howling cheer that echoed through the mountains. Campbell couldn't believe it. As Gain's lord, it behoved him to stay neutral, but it was impossible. Surging to his feet, he leapt from the platform and joined the crowd, cheering at the top of his voice. Borak hurtled headlong into the wall of sound, which panicked him, for he could no longer hear the man behind him. He knew it was senseless to glance back, for it would cost him speed. But he couldn't help himself. His head turned, and there, just behind him, was Egwene, blood streaming from his injured mouth. Borak tried to increase his pace. The finishing line was only 50 paces away, but the distance stretched out before him like an eternity. Egwene drew abreast of him once more, and then was past. The crowd was delirious. The rope lanes were trampled down, and Egwene swallowed by the mass, only to be hoisted aloft on the shoulders of 2 fallen men. Borak stumbled away, head bowed, then stopped, and sought out his master. Asbadag stood silently gazing down from the Hunt Lord's platform. Borak met his gaze and turned away.
"There is still Orsa," said Drada.
His father nodded, then watched the broken Borak walking away from the tents of the Anir.
"I don't want to see his face again."
"I'll send him south," said Drada.
"I don't want anyone to see his face again."
Clan Fervor, which had seemed to reach a peak following Egwene's unexpected and courageous victory, hit new heights during the long afternoon. No one toured the stalls, nor sat in comfort at the table sipping mead or wine. The entire crowd thronged the central field, where Lennox and Orsa battled for the Whirl trophy.
awarded to the strongest man of the mountains. That the two men were splendidly matched had been obvious from the culling events, when both had moved comfortably to the final. Both towered over 6 feet. In physique they were near identical, their huge frames swollen with thick corded muscle. Diva thought them equally ugly, though the male watchers gazed in frank admiration. The event had 5 sections. The first man to win 3 of them would be the world champion. The first saw Orsa win easily. A sphere of lead weighing 20 pounds had to be hurled one-handed. Orsa's first throw measured 18.5 paces. Lennox managed only 13. But the clansmen drew level in the next event, straightening a horseshoe. Watching the contest with Galen and Meg, Caswellan was concerned. The Anir is more supple, and therefore his speed is greater. That's why he won the hurling so easily, and it must make him the favourite for the open wrestling. The third event involved lifting the whirlstone and carrying it along a roped lane. Lennox was first to make the attempt. The black boulder had been carried to a wooden platform at the head of the lane, 200 pounds of slippery stone. Lennox approached it, breathing deeply, and the crowd fell silent, allowing him to concentrate on the task ahead. The weight was not the problem. Set the boulder on a harness and Lennox could carry it across the Druin range. But held across the chest, every step loosened the grip. A strong man could carry it 10 paces. A very strong man might make 20, but only those with colossal power carried it beyond 30. The man now known as Oracle had in his youth made 42 paces. Men still spoke of it. Lennox bent his knees and curled his mighty arms around the stone, tensing the muscles of his shoulders and back. Straightening his legs with a grunt of effort, he slowly turned and began to walk the lane. At 15 paces, the stone slipped, but he held it more firmly and walked on. At 30 paces, the steps became smaller. Gone was the slow, measured stride. His head strained back, the muscles and tendons of his neck stood out like bars of iron. At 40 paces, his face was crimson, the veins on his temples writhing, his eyes squeezed shut. At 45 paces, Lennox stumbled, made one more step, then jumped back as he was forced to release the weight. 3 men prized the stone clear, while a 4th marked the spot with a white stake. Sucking in great gasps of air, Lennox sought out his opponent, reading his face for signs of concern. Orsa ran his hand through his thick yellow hair, sweeping it back from his eyes. He grinned at Lennox, a friendly, open smile. Lennox's heart sank. To the stunned amazement of the crowd, Orsa carried the whirlstone easily past the stake, releasing it at 57 paces. It was an incredible feat, and even the clansmen applauded it. Men's eyes switched to Lennox, knowing the blow to his morale would be great. He was sitting on the grass watching his opponent, his face set, features stern. Campbell called for a halt to allow the contestants to recover their strength before the rope haul, and the crowd broke away to mead tables and the barbecue pits. Caswellan and Galen made their way to Lennox, along with Agwain, Campbell, and Lane.
"Can you beat 'em?" asked Campbell.
"Not no, cousin," snapped Caswellan. "Let him rest."
Campbell's eyes flashed angrily, and he turned away. Agwain hesitated, then followed his father.
"How'd you feel?"
asked Caswellan, sitting down. Lennox grinned and shrugged.
"I feel broken. Who can any man carry that stone for almost 60 pieces? It's inhuman."
"I thought the same when you carried it for 46.
"I don't think I can beat him."
"You can?"
"You've not been watching very closely, cousin."
"Ah, but I have, Lennox, and that's how I know. He took a lower grip and kept his head down. Your head was back. That shortened your steps. You could have matched him. You still can."
Don't misunderstand me, Caswellan. I shall do my best, but he is stronger. There's no doubt of that.
I know.
But he's not fallen, said Galen. You are.
Lennox grinned.
So speaks our limping cousin, who allowed a mere 5 a year to remove him from the race.
Galen chuckled.
I meant it, though. I don't think he can beat you, Lennox. I don't think there's a man alive to beat you. You'll see. That's a comforting thought, Galen, and I thank you for it.
Lennox grunted as he stretched his back.
Roll on your stomach, commanded Lane. I'll need that muscle for you.
Caswellan helped Galen to his feet, for his legs stiffened as he sat.
Let's get some food. How'd you feel?
I ache. Damn, Caswellan. I wish I'd run in that race.
Why?
I wanted to do something for the clan. Be someone.
You are someone, and we all know you would have won. But it was better for Agwain to do it.
Why?
Because Agwain needed to do it. Today he learned something about himself. In some ways he's like his father, full of doubts. Today he lost a lot of them. That may be good for Agwain, but it doesn't help me.
How true, said Caswellan, ruffling Galen's hair.
But there is always next year.
That afternoon began with a rope haul, a supreme test of a man's strength and stamina. The contestant looped a rope around his body and braced himself. On the other end, 3 men sought to tug him from his feet. After 10 heartbeats, a 4th man could be added to the team. 10 beats later, another man, and so on. This time Orsa went first. The men trying to dislodge him were Farlan clansmen. Bracing his foot against a deeply embedded rock, he held the 1st 3 men with ease, taunting them and exhorting them to pull harder. By the time 6 men were pulling against him, he had run out of jeers, saving his breath for the task in hand. The 7th man proved too much for him, and he fell forward, hitting the ground hard. He was up in an instant, grinning and complaining that the rock beneath his foot had slipped. Lennox stepped up to the mark. A blanket rolled across his shoulders to prevent rope burn. Swiftly, he coiled the rope, hooking it over his shoulder and back. Then he checked the stone. It was firm. He braced himself, and 3 Aenir warriors took up the slack. A 4th man was sent forward, then a 5th. Lennox wasted no energy taunting them. He closed his mind to his opponents. He was a rock, set in the mountain. Immovable. A tree, deeply rooted and strong. His eyes closed, his concentration intense. He felt the building of power against him, and absorbed it. At last, the pressure grew too great, and he gave way, opening his eyes to count his opponents. 9 men! Dropping the rope, he turned to Orsa. The Aenir warrior met his gaze and nodded slowly. He was not smiling now, as he walked forward to stand before the dark-haired clansman. Blue eyes met grey. Orsa was in his late 20s, a seasoned warrior who had never been beaten and never would be. His confidence was born of knowledge, experience, and the pain borne by others. Lennox was nearing 18, untried in war and combat, but he had faced the beast and stood his ground. Now he faced the Aenir, and his gaze remained cool and steady. Orsa nodded once and turned away. With 2 events each, the World Championship would be decided in the open wrestling, a cultured euphemism for a fight where the only rule was that there were no rules. It was held in a rope circle 6 paces in diameter, and the first to be thrown from the ring was the loser. As they prepared, Caswellan approached Lennox and whispered in his ear. The huge clansman nodded, then stepped into the circle. Orsa stepped in to join him, and the 2 men shook hands, acknowledging the cheers of the crowd. Then they backed away and began to circle, hands extended. Suddenly Lennox stepped inside and lightly slapped Orsa's face. Expecting a punch, the Aeneid ducked and stepped back. Lennox flicked his hand out again, this time slapping Orsa's arm. Someone in the crowd began to laugh, and others joined in. Lennox dummied a right, then slapped Orsa once more, this time with his left hand. The laughter swelled. Orsa's blue eyes glittered strangely, and he began to tremble. With a piercing scream, he charged his tormentor. No more did he merely seek to throw him from the circle. Now only death would avenge the insult. Orsa was once again a Barazark. Lennox met the charge head-on, swiveling to thunder a right hook to Orsa's bearded chin. The Aeneid shrugged off the blow and charged again. This time, Lennox hit him with both hands, but a wildly swinging punch from Orsa exploded against his ear. Lennox staggered. A left-hand punch broke Lennox's nose, blood spattering to his chin. Warding off the attack with a desperate push, the clansman moved back to the edge of the circle. Orsa charged once more, screaming an Aeneid battle cry. At the last moment, Lennox dropped to his knees, then surged upright as Orsa loomed over him. The speed of the rush carried Orsa on, flying headlong over his opponent to crash into the crowd beyond the circle. The fight was over, and Lennox had won. But Orsa, in his berserk rage, knew nothing of tournaments and petty victories. Hurling aside the men who helped him to his feet, he leapt back into the circle where Lennox was standing with arms raised in triumph. "Look out!" shouted Galen and a score of others. Lennox swung round. Orsa's massive hands encircled the clansman's throat. Instinctively, Lennox tensed the muscles of his neck against the crushing strength of the man's fingers. His own hands clamped down on Orsa's throat, blocking his demonic snarling. The crowd fell silent as the two men strained and swayed in the center of the circle. Then the tall red-caped figure of Drada appeared, pushing through the mass. In his right hand he carried a wooden club, which he hammered to the back of his brother's skull. Orsa's eyes glazed, and his grip loosened. Drada hit him once more, and he fell. Lennox stepped back, rubbing his bruised throat. Orsa staggered to his feet, turning to his brother.
"Sorry,"
he said, and shrugged. He walked to Lennox, gripping his hand.
"Good contest,"
he said.
"You are strong." "I don't think any man will ever carry the whirlstone as far as you did,"
Lennox told him.
"Maybe so. Why did you slap me?"
The question was asked so simply and directly that Lennox laughed nervously, unable at first to marshal his thoughts, but also waited patiently, no sign of emotion on his broad face.
"I did it to make you angry, so you would lose control. Thought so. Beat myself. That's not good."
Still nodding, he walked away. Lennox watched him, puzzled. Then the crowd swamped him, slapping his back and leading him on to the Hunt Lord's platform to receive the congratulations of the game's lord. As the crowd moved away, Drada approached Caswellan.
"It was your advice, was it not, to make my brother Barazark?"
"Yes."
"You are proving to be troublesome, Caswellan."
"I'm glad to hear it.
No sensible man should be glad to make an enemy."
"I haven't made an enemy, Drada. I've recognized one. There is a difference."
The whirl dance had begun around a dozen blazing fires, and the eligible maidens of the Farlan chose dancing companions from the waiting ranks of clansmen. There was music from the pipes, harsh and powerful, from the flute, wistful and melodic, and the horn, the harp, enchanting and fey. It was mountain music, and stronger than wine upon the senses of the men and women of the clans. Deva danced with Lane, the spear champion, while Galen sat alone, fighting a losing battle against self-pity. His leg ached, and he eased it forward under the table, rubbing at the swollen thigh. Gwalchmai found him there just before midnight. The young archer was dressed in his finest clothes,
a cloak of soft brown leather over a green embroidered tunic.
"No one should be alone on Whirl Night," said Gwal, easing in to sit opposite his comrade.
"I was just waiting for a girl with a swollen left leg, then we could hobble away together," said Galen, pouring more mead wine into his goblet.
"I have two legs, but have not found a partner," said Gwal, helping himself to Galen's wine.
"Come now, Gwal, there must be 500 maidens here."
"They're not what I want," said Gwalchmai sadly.
Galen glanced at his friend. Gwal's hair was flame red in the firelight, his face no longer boyish, but lean and handsome.
"So, what do you want? A princess?"
Gwalchmai shrugged.
"That is hard to answer, Galen. But I know I shall never wed."
Galen said nothing. He'd known for some time, as had Lane and Lennox, that Gwalchmai had no interest in the young maidens of the Farlan. The boys did not understand it, but only Galen suspected the truth. In Arteris, he had seen many who shared Gwalchmai's secret longings.
"You know what I am, don't you?" said Gwalchmai suddenly.
"I know," Galen told him. "You are Gwalchmai, one of the beast slayers. You are a clansman, and I am proud to have you for my friend."
"Then you don't think—"
"I have told you what I think, cousin," said Galen, reaching forward to grip Gwalchmai's shoulder.
"True enough."
"Thank you, my friend,"
Gwalchmai sighed, and changed the subject.
"Where is Caswallon?"
"Escorting the Aeneir back to Asgard."
"I am not sorry to see them go," said Gwal.
"No. Did you hear about Borak, the runner? What about him?"
"He was found this evening, hanging from a tree on the West Hill.
He killed himself."
"It seems so," said Galen.
"They're a strange people, these Aeneir. I hope they don't come back next year."
"I think they will, but not for the games," said Galen.
"You're not another of those war boars."
"I'm afraid so."
"What could they gain? There are no riches in Druin."
"War is a prize in itself for the Aeneir. They live for it."
Gwalchmai leaned forward on his elbows, shaking his head.
"What a night. First I lose in the archery, then I get maudlin, and now I'm sitting here with a man who prophesies war and death."
Galen chuckled.
"You were unlucky in the tourney. The wind died as the Aeneir took his mark, and it gave him an edge."
"A thousand blessings on you for noticing," said Gwal, grinning.
"Have you ever been drunk?"
"No."
"Well, it seems the only enjoyment left to us."
"I agree. Fetch another jug."
Within an hour, their raucous songs had attracted a small following. Lennox and Agwain joined them, bringing fresh supplies. Then Lane arrived with Diva. The drink ran out just before dawn, and the party moved to sit beside a dying fire. The songs faded away, the laughter eased, and the talk switched to the games and the possible aftermath. Diva fell asleep against Lane. He settled her to the ground, covering her with his cloak. Galen watched him gently tuck the garment around her, and his heart ached. He looked away, trying to focus on the conversation once more, but he could not. His gaze swept up over the mountains, along the reddening skyline. Caswallon had told him his theory of the Aeneir plan to demoralize the clans. The scale of their error was enormous. By the end, they achieved only the opposite. Men of every clan had cheered Agwain and Lennox against a common enemy. They had united the clans in a way no one had in 100 years. He heard someone mention his name and dragged his mind back to the present.
"I'm sorry you missed the race," said Agwain.
"Don't be. You were magnificent. Caswallon advised me."
"It was obviously good advice."
"Yes. I'm sorry he and my father are not friends."
"And you?
What about me? How do you feel now? About Caswellan, I mean. I am grateful, but I am my father's son. I understand. I hope that you do, cousin. The eyes met, and Egwene held out his hand. Galen took it.
No, this is good to see, said Lennox, leaning forward to lay his hand upon theirs.
Lane and Gwalchmai followed suit. We are all Farlane, said Lane solemnly, brothers of the spirit.
Let it long remain so. The five beast slayers, said Egwene, grinning. It is fitting we should be friends.
Deva opened her eyes and saw the five young men sitting silently together. The sun cleared the mountains, bathing them in golden light. She blinked and sat up. Just for a moment, she seemed to see a sixth figure standing beyond them. Tall she was, and beautiful, silver-haired and strong. By her side hung a mighty sword, and upon her head was a crown of gold. Deva shivered and blinked again. The queen was gone. Chapter 7 Galen stood on the lip of a precipice, looking down on Valon from the north, listening to the faint sounds of the falls echoing up through the mountains. Spring had finally arrived, after yet another bitter winter, and Galen had been anxious to leave the valley, to stretch his legs and open his heart to the music of the mountains. He had grown during the winter, and constant work with axe and saw had added weight to his arms and shoulders. His hair was long, hanging to his shoulders, and held back from his eyes by a black leather circle around his brow. Corrine, before her marriage to the West Valley crofter Dirk, had made it for him, as well as a tunic of softest leather, polished to a sheen, and calf-length moccasin boots from the same hide. His winter cape was a gift from Caswellan, a heavy sheepskin that doubled as a blanket. During the cold winter months, he had allowed his beard to grow, shutting his ears to jibes about goose down from Meg and Corrine. It had taken long enough, but now, as he stood on the mountainside in the early morning sunshine, it gave him that which he desired above all else, the look of manhood. Gone was the frightened, wounded boy, brought home by Caswellan 2 years before. In his place stood a man, tall and strong, hardened by toil, strengthened by experience. The only reminders left of the hunted boy were the blood-filled left eye and the white streak in his hair above the jagged scar on his forehead and cheek. The black and grey warhand by his side growled and rubbed against him. Galen dropped his hand to pat its massive head. "You don't like these high places, do you, boy?" said Galen, squatting beside the animal. It lifted its head, licking his face until he pushed it away, laughing. "We've changed, you and I," he said, holding the dog at bay. It had the wide jaws of its dam and the heavy shoulders of its breed, but added to this, it also had the rangy power of the wolf that had sired it. The wolf in it had caused problems with training, and both Caswellan and Galen had despaired at times. But slowly it had come round to their patient handling, until at last Galen had walked it unleashed among a flock of sheep. He told it to sit, and it obeyed him. But his eyes lingered over the fat, slow ewes, and its jaws salivated. After a while it had hunkered down on its haunches and closed its eyes, unable to bear such mouth-watering sights any longer. Under Caswellan's guidance, Galen taught the hound to obey increasingly complex instructions, beginning with simple commands such as sit, heel, and stay. After that it was taught to wait in silence if Galen lifted his hand palm outward. Finally Caswellan built a dummy of wood and straw, dressed it in old clothes, and the hound was taught to attack it on Galen's command of kill. This training was further refined with the call, hold, at which command the dog would lunge for the dummy's arm. Painstakingly, they honed the dog's skills. Once it attacked, only one call would stop it. Home. Any other call, even from Galen, would be ignored.
"This," said Caswellan, "is your safeguard. For a dog is a creature of instinct. You may order it to attack, but another voice may call it back. Home should remain a secret command. Share it, not even with your friends."
Galen called the beast Render. The hound's nature was good, especially with Caswellan's son Donal, now a blonde toddler, who followed Render, or Wenna, as he called it, about the house, pulling its ears and struggling to climb on its back. Attempts to stop him would be followed by floods of tears, and the difficult-to-answer assertion, "When I like it!" Meg was hard to convince that Render was a worthy addition to the household, but one afternoon in late winter, it won her over. Corrine had ventured into the yard to fetch wood for the fire, but had not secured the kitchen door on her return. Donal had sneaked out to play in the snow, an adventure of rare magic. He was gone for more than half an hour before his absence was noted. Meg was beside herself. Caswellan and Galen were at the Long Hall, where Caswellan was being elected to the council, in place of an elderly clansman who had collapsed and died soon after the games. Meg wrapped a woolen shawl about her shoulders and stepped out into the storm. Within minutes it had grown dark, and as she called Donald's name, the wind whipped her words from her mouth. His track had been covered by fresh snow. Corrine joined her. "He'll die in this!" yelled Meg. Render padded from the house. Seeing the hound, Meg ran to it and knelt beside it.
"Donal!"
she shouted, pushing the dog and pointing out past the yard. Render tilted his head and licked her face.
"Fetch!"
she shouted. Render looked around. There was nothing to fetch.
"Donal! Fetch! Donal!"
Render looked back towards the house and the open door that led to the warm hearth. The hound didn't know what the women were doing out in the cold. Then its ears came up, as a wolf howled in the distance. Another sound came, thin and piping. Recognizing instantly the pup child of Caswellan, Render padded off into the snow. Meg's hands and feet were freezing, but she had no idea if the dog had understood her, and she had not heard the faint cry, so she continued to search, terror growing within her and panic welling in her mind. Render loped away into a small hollow hidden from the house. Here it found the toddler, who had slipped and rolled down onto a patch of ice and was unable to get up. Beyond him sat two wolves, tongues lolling. Render padded towards the boy, growling deep in his throat. The wolves stood, then backed away as the warhound advanced. Canny killers were the grey wolves, but they knew a better killer when they saw him.
"I called, Wenna," said Donal, sniffing. "I called."
Render stopped by the boy, watching the wolves carefully. They backed away still further, and satisfied, Render nuzzled Donal. But the boy could not stand on the ice. Render ducked his head, taking the boy's woolen tunic in his teeth. Donal was lifted clear of the ice, and the huge dog bounded up the slope and back towards the house. Meg saw them, and waded through the snow towards them, but Render loped past her and into the kitchen. He was cold and missed the fire. When Meg and Corrine arrived, Donal and Render were sitting before the hearth. Meg swept Donal into her arms.
"Wolves, Mama! Wenna, scare em away!"
Meg shuddered. Wolves? And her child had been alone? She sat down hurriedly. Neither of the women told Caswellan of the adventure, but he knew something was amiss when Meg explained she had given his own cold meat supper to the hound. Caswellan's activities during the summer and winter puzzled many of the clansmen. He drove no cattle to Asgard, nor delivered grain and oats. The fruits of his orchards disappeared, and no man knew where, though the carts were driven into the mountains by trusted workers.
There, it was said, they were delivered to the druids. In the meantime, Caswellan gathered round him more than 100 clansmen, and several of these he paid to scatter.